We are in Judges chapter 5. And it was an interesting and fun chapter to go through and study in the Hebrew. There are different things that come out in the different language. But we jump in, we'll do section by section. I'll let you know what the limits of the different sections are. And as we go through it, we do a few verses. So we begin with verse one. Then sang Deborah and Barak, the son of Abinoam, on that day. And it is a song of victory. And Deborah and Barak sing the song. It is known as Deborah's song. And Deborah and Barak, she's taking the lead. She is the prophetess. Okay, in English, we put the female as a prefix at the beginning of the word, male and female. In Hebrew, it's done at the end of the word, ish and isha. So she is isha navi'ah, woman prophetess. And very interesting because it's quite a deliberate thing there. That was verse one. Verse two, someone.
That the leaders took the lead in Israel, that the people offered themselves willingly, bless the Lord.
Okay. Now the Jewish Publication Society, JPS, translation goes like this. When locks go untrimmed in Israel, when people dedicate themselves, bless the Lord. Very different. That's an idiom. And you might remember back when God was setting down the law at Mount Sinai and telling the people how they were to mark themselves out as different from all the other nations. One of the little things was do not trim the corners of your hair. And so as they moved into Canaan and started adopting the practices of the nations around them, they forgot about that. So this is a return to being devoted and dedicated to God. Leaders took the lead when the strong in Israel showing themselves strong, the people offering themselves willingly. It's a time of dedication where it's in the cycle of the judges. The people wander off, God sends discipline, they return to him, God sends a deliverer. So this is the they return to him marked out in verse 2. Okay, so far? Then the next section is verses 3, 4, and 5. We'll read verse 3. Hear, O kings, give ear, O princes, to the Lord I will sing. I will make melody to the Lord, the God of Israel. Very straightforward. Verse 4.
O Lord, when you went out from Seir, when you marched from the land of Edom, the earth shook, the heavens poured, the clouds poured down water.
Okay. And Seir is toward the east, Edom toward the south and east. And it's talking about when God stepped up to guide his people into the Holy Land, when you came forth. And then the second part of the verse echoes things from Mount Sinai. The earth trembled. The heavens dripped, the clouds dripped water. The cloud, the storm, the thunder, the lightning on Mount Sinai is what is being called to remembrance. Verse 5, the mountains quaked before the Lord, even Sinai before the Lord, the God of Israel. And that is how Delitzsch translates it as well. The JPS, the mountains quaked before the Lord, him of Sinai, before the Lord, God of Israel. It's simply a different division of the verse to put Sinai in the middle part instead of in the last part. But it is, again, calling to mind, this is the God of Sinai. This is the God... There's the morning stuff. This is the God who told his people that he would go forth and he would lead them forth and he would lead them into the promised land. The God of Sinai is the one God, the only God. So finishes the first portion. Is it strophe?
Well,
of a song,
in poetry, yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
okay. The first strophe,
verse. Strophe. Don't know.
The second strophe would be verses 6 through 8, and this will set the stage for the need for deliverance. So, verse 6.
In the days of Shamgar, son of Anath, in the days of Jael, the highways were abandoned and the travelers kept to the byways.
Okay. Now, Shamgar is one of the judges who earlier on, a couple chapters earlier, went after the Philistines with an ox goad.
Oh, that's the one.
Yeah, that's the one. But in the days of Shamgar, it does not say that Shamgar did this and this, and then the land had so many years of rest. So Shamgar was part of the resistance in the middle of a time of distress. And Jael, she will come in later on because she's the one that nailed Sisera's head to the floor. She nailed me head to the floor. And in their days, when there were individuals resisting, what was the situation in Israel? Using the JPS, caravans ceased. Wayfarers went by roundabout paths. They did not want to go on the main roads because there were
highwaymen.
No, not highwaymen. The king of Canaan and the army of Sisera. And if you got stopped on the roads, they'd take everything you had. There was nothing you could do. You hid stuff in the back, along the back pathways, and you took these circuitous routes that probably were rough paths and up and down and all over the place that the occupying army wouldn't bother with. everything that had to do with commerce and everything else was hidden from the enemy army. Verse 7, the villagers ceased in Israel, they ceased to be until I arose. I, Deborah, arose as a mother in Israel. The actual Hebrew has second person, till you arose, O Deborah, but she is speaking it to herself. It's another idiomatic pattern of speech. And a mother in Israel has become a judge. Mothers can be very aggressive when they step up and decide that they're going to get the way for their children and their people. They can be very aggressive, can't they? Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. Verse 8.
When they chose new gods, war came to the city gates, and not a shield or spear was seen among 40,000 in Israel.
What are these new gods that they chose?
The Canaanites' gods?
Yep.
So they didn't have to fight because they gave over to the enemy.
Yeah, well... that never works.
No.
You give in to the enemy, the enemy wants more.
That's why we keep doing it. Why do we
keep doing it?
Easier.
Delitzsch points out that the last part of the verse is phrased as a question. Was there a shield seen and a spear among 40,000 in Israel? Why were there no arms in Israel? Surely they had them before. Where were they?
They melted them down and made them into idols.
actually, no. Who had their shields and spears that they had had before?
Canaanites.
Yeah, the occupying army. That's the first thing you do. You disarm the populace.
Yep, give us your guns. Give us your spears.
Spear and shield.
Spear and shield. So was it the Philistines or was it the Sisera? But who was, what group was he with?
Jabin, king of Canaan. Who reigned in Hazor. That's the Canaanites of the northern part of the Holy Land. And it does divide into north and south. Also divides into east and west. But the Canaanites of the north, they just had reconstituted, had seized power. And so it will be the tribes of the north that have to fight back. Okay. Third strophe, verses 9 through 11. From the contemplation of the deep degradation to the glorious change which took place as soon as she appeared. So, this is what is going to happen. Verse 9. Where am I? I'm juggling between three different translations here. My heart goes out to the commanders of Israel who offered themselves willingly among the people. Bless the Lord. Her heart inclines, her heart leans toward, she really loves the leaders of Israel, these new leaders who offer themselves publicly. And remember back in verse 2. When locks go untrimmed, it is a religious dedication that they are offering themselves with. And this is the leaders of Israel who have stepped up to be the true leaders and dedicated themselves to the Lord. And this is where Deborah is saying the beginning of, bless the Lord, there is deliverance. Verse 10.
You who ride on white donkeys, sitting on your saddle blankets, and you who walk along the road, consider the... goes into 11.
Different translations. Tell of it, you who ride on white donkeys, you who sit on rich carpets, and you who walk by the way. There's three divisions in Israel.
White donkey is a king, right?
Actually, there is no white donkey, so it's donkeys that are spotted with white. Mm-hmm. And that is, you're more expensive. It's the Cadillac of donkeys. And the Mercedes-Benz of jackasses. you gotta have style. I mean, white spots on your donkey, what's better than that? So these are the leaders. Secondly is those who sit on rich carpets. And those are the ones with fine houses. And then the third group is those who go about their business trudging along, walking from place to place. All of Israel, from the highest to the lowest, the fanciest to the simplest. Okay. What verse are we at now?
11.
Okay. To the sound of musicians at the watering places, there they repeat the righteous triumphs of the Lord, the righteous triumphs of his villagers in Israel. Jewish Publication Society, louder than the sound of archers there among the watering places, let them chant the gracious acts of the Lord, his gracious deliverance of Israel. Then did the people of the Lord march down to the gates. As an interesting phrasing there in the Hebrew, because what they're calling to mind is, now after the battle, this is what will happen. The archers who were part of this battle will be off at the watering places with the young ladies and the shepherdesses of the villages, and they'll be telling the stories of the battle. And, well, you get the idea, right? Kind of boasting of their experience and maybe stretching it a little bit, but they were involved. I was a part of this charge and that charge. And the archers, by the way, are many of them from Benjamin. The Benjaminites had a thing about archery and were very good at it.
Yeah, how come this translation doesn't include archery?
I don't know. Delitzsch does, JPS does. I do not know. With the voices of the archers among drawers of water, there praise ye the righteous acts of the Lord.
Yeah, I'm saying musicians here.
Yeah.
Saying
I'm not going to explain the simplified and watered down translation if I get a richer translation.
Yeah, they say storytellers who told of the Lord's victory.
Mm-hmm.
The footnote down here does say, or archers, the meaning of the Hebrew word is uncertain. And that's your ESV.
Yeah. All translations make choices.
Mm-hmm.
Many of the English translations pull back and play it safe. They won't translate rude words, and they won't take risks in translation. And if it's more difficult to explain a certain translation, they usually back off. And yeah, I like the more dramatic, just saying. Okay. Verse 12.
Awake, awake, Deborah. Awake, awake. Break out in a song. Arise, Barak. Lead your captives, O son of Abinoam.
Yep. And anticipating the end, then it's back to the beginning. Up and arise and awake and go forth and march out and win the victory. So that was a tail on to the previous strophe. And then comes the next strophe, which is verses 13 through most of 15. So verse 13. Then down marched the remnant of the noble. The people of the Lord marched down for me against the mighty. And said, see, this is setting it up. A remnant being made victorious over the mighty, the Lord's people over this large army. How did it happen? Verse 14.
From Ephraim, their route, they marched down into the valley, following you, Benjamin, with your kinsmen. From Machir marched down the commanders, and from Zebulun, those who bear the lieutenant's staff.
Mm-hmm. Okay, first off, take on Machir. Tribe of Manasseh was divided into two parts, those west of the Jordan and those east of the Jordan. And for some reason, they began to go by two names. Gilead was those east of the Jordan, and Machir, those west of the Jordan. So from Ephraim came they. And then JPS and Delitzsch translates, came they whose roots are in Amalek, which is a reference to those who lived in the land before Ephraim rolled in and took over the land and drove them out. And the Amalekites were very mighty. And so this is a nod to Ephraim, who overcame the mighty. And then after them come Benjamin, which this may be simply a perspective thing, because they're to the north of Ephraim. And if you from that spot look southward, you will see first Ephraim, then Benjamin. So Benjamin is following along. Machir, the tribe of Manasseh that's west of the Jordan. Zebulun, Naphtali, and so on. Zebulun coming from the north to come down south to this. Verse 14 is where we're at. Okay. Those who bear the lieutenant's staff is a pretty good translation. Verse 15. The princes of Issachar came with Deborah, and Issachar, faithful to Barak, into the valley they rushed at his heels. Okay. So now we've gotten as far as describing the battle, rushing down from the mountain into the valley. And Delitzsch at this point goes into some detail describing the valley. There's a lot of streams and brooks and rivulets and everything else. And as they come rushing down, it says in Judges 4, the Lord discomfited Sisera. Things started going wrong. In a valley of that sort, if you get some rain, your chariots are not going to work very well. They'll sink into the mud. And here come those who are on foot. And when you're on foot, you can travel through it. And when you're in a chariot and it's stuck, you get problems. And so the acts of the army, the soldiers of Sisera, were to try and get away, try and get into some dry ground and be able to have the chariots work. And by the way, if I think I mentioned this last time, if the people of Israel had simply stayed up on the mountain and let Sisera come up and attack them, then they would have been fighting on drier ground with chariots working much better. But because they were bold and went down and attacked in the valley, then they had the advantage of now it's all wet and the chariots aren't working. Okay, that finishes that strophe. The second part of 15 on through verse 18. And the second part of 15 says, among the clans of Reuben, there were great searchings of heart. What? Someone take verse 16.
Why did you sit still among the sheepfolds to hear the whistling for the flocks? Among the clans of Reuben, there were great searchings of heart.
Yeah, they talked about going. Does that sound like a fair description of searchings of heart? And they talked about going, but didn't. This is the portion of heaping scorn. Verse 17, Gilead stayed beyond the Jordan. And Dan, why did he stay with the ships? Asher sat still at the coast of the sea, staying by his landings. And now in contrast, verse 18.
Zebulun is a people who risk their lives to the death. Naphtali too, to the heights of the field.
Okay. So the note from Delitzsch, Judah and Simeon are not mentioned. Why are they not mentioned? Could be they were never summoned. They were way in the south. Could be that they were so involved in the conflict with the Philistines that they couldn't. And Delitzsch says, even apart from Judah and Simeon, The lack of sympathy on the part of the tribes that are reproved here is a sufficient proof that the enthusiasm for the cause of the Lord had greatly diminished. The internal unity of the congregation was considerably loosened. Yeah. Okay. The next strophe is verses 19, 20, and 21. And verse 19. Oh. Delitzsch's translation is better. Kings came, they fought. Very brief summary type, just four words. Don't even bother putting it in a complete sentence. Kings came, they fought. And then fought the kings of Canaan at Taanach by the waters of Megiddo. They got no spoils of silver. And I'm going, say what, say what, say what? Taanach, we see that mentioned in Joshua 12. The waters of Megiddo. What is this? Do you know a end times word that may be related to the name Megiddo?
Armageddon?
Yeah. Armageddon has the, actually in Hebrew, Harmageddon, with Har being mountain. But the waters of Megiddo? No, Megiddo is off by the shore. And the most prominent mountain by Megiddo is Mount Carmel, of Elijah and the priests of Baal, and the sacrifice accepted with fire from heaven. But the waters of Megiddo would be upstream from that town, quite a ways upstream. The waters of Megiddo then would place the spot of the battle, Valley of Jezreel, as a spot where so many important battles were fought that this is the place of conflict. And because this is the place of conflict, when we read about this battle, we should think about we're having a little bit of a pre-echoing of the final battle, which if you say it like that, then, well, that's interesting, because the final battle, is that going to be where the enemies of the Lord gather together to fight against the people of God, and something happens and they're left stuck? Meanwhile, God's people are given the victory without ever having to do much of anything. The enemy thinks they've got chariots. Well, let's just toss in a little bit of rain and see how that works. All of the plans go completely wrong, and the people of God coming down from the hill. But when you get to the actual description of the Battle of Armageddon in the book of Revelation, it's like there isn't a battle. They all gather together against the Lord, and then fire comes down from heaven and destroys them. It's like, but wait a minute. Why is the movie over so quickly? Where's the chase scene? Where's the glorious final battle? Just, it's done. And that also is a part of the image. But notice the themes joining together of dedication and worship, of turning to the Lord when locks go untrimmed, dedication to the Lord, and the people of God being called out to be the people of God who stand up in the face of these things. And when God has decided to give the victory, this is what happens. The enemy fights, but there's not even a little bit of silver that they get. Okay. Verse 20.
From heaven the stars fought. From their courses they fought against Sisera.
And the images of the stars leaving their appointed courses. How do we explain that? Are we talking horoscope and astrology or anything like that? No. If you go to the book of Job and you find one of the descriptions of the angels is the stars of the heavens. And so God employs, God is the Lord of Sabaoth, which means the Lord of angel armies. And all kinds of things happen when God deploys his angel armies, and the army of Sisera finds out that he's not just fighting a battle here on the ground. He's got an enemy who has called in air cover, and all of a sudden, everything's lost. Verse 21, the torrent Kishon swept them away. The ancient torrent, the torrent Kishon. March on, my soul, with might. Delitzsch, the brook of Kishon. And then at the end, go on, my soul, in strength. Deborah is apparently at that point urging herself to go on and sing even greater praises. But was there a flash flood? Could have been. This is an indication that there was a storm that influenced the battle. And because of the storm, the army of Sisera had nowhere to turn, just time to run away. Leads into the next strophe, which is 22, 23, 24. So somebody 22.
Then thundered the horse's hooves, galloping, galloping, go his mighty steeds.
And if you didn't pick up on this, it's mockery. Here's the mighty steeds galloping. Where are they galloping to? They're running away. Okay. Loud beat the horse's hooves, galloping, galloping. Verse 23. There is a town, Meraz, who was right on that path, and if they'd come out, it would have ended the battle. The army of Sisera would have been surrounded, nowhere to turn, and died right there, but they didn't. And so the army of Gideon, no, not the army of Barak, I've been reading ahead. The army of Barak has to pursue and pursue and pursue and pursue and pursue. So verse 23, curse Meraz, says the angel of the Lord, curse its inhabitants thoroughly because they did not come to the help of the Lord, to the help of the Lord against the mighty. Okay. Verse 24. Here comes jail.
Most blessed of women be Jael, the wife of Heber, the Kenite, of tent-dwelling women most blessed.
Okay. The next strophe is going to be a much closer description of what happened with as much poetry as Deborah can put into it. Verse 25. He asked water, she gave him milk. She handed him cream in the dish of nobles. Curds, yogurt, very rich. And she brought it in the finest bowl set aside for entertaining. If you ever have a guest who is of the nobility, and by doing that, she is recognizing his status and entertaining him as a, so to speak, a guest that I am not worthy to have you in my tent. Let me give you, here's the finest bowl. Let me give you the richest of what I've got. Verse 26.
He sent her hand to the tent peg and her right hand to the workman's mouth.
Okay. So the first part, she sent her hand to the tent peg, and that would be a more literal first step translation than you expect in English translations. Sent her hand to the tent peg, her right hand to the workman's hammer or mallet of the hard workers is a large, heavy hammer. This is not your nail driving hammer. This is the bigger one. Okay. And the description in there is also to emphasize Jael's strength. She's not just a woman, she's a strong woman. And then she struck Sisera, she crushed his head, she shattered and pierced his temple, and hammered Sisera, broke his head and dashed in pieces and pierced his temples. Okay. And if you line it up right, and if you have the big hammer, it's one swing, one blow, and that's it. This is not to express the delight of satisfied thirst for revenge, simply to bring out the thought that Sisera, who was for years the terror of Israel, was now struck dead with a single blow. Verse 27. Between her feet, he sank, he fell, he lay still. Between her feet, he sank, he fell. Where he sank, there he fell dead. And the ESV reading it like that gets the poetry and the meter, gets it exactly right. End of that strophe. The next strophe, kind of the final one, is verses 28 to 30. And it turns then to Sisera's mother. Verse 28.
Through the window peered Sisera's mother. Behind the lattice, she cried out, Why is his chariot so long in coming? Why is the clatter of his chariots delayed?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Her wisest princess's answer. Okay, no, go with Dilich. The wise of her princess's reply, but she repeats her words to herself. Although the princesses in the palace are answering and giving explanations, she is repeating the question. She is unable to get loose of that question. And then verse 30 is what the princesses and what she wants to believe of this delay. So verse 30.
Have they not found and divided the spoil, a womb or two for every man, spoil of dyed materials for Sisera, spoil of dyed materials embroidered, 2 pieces of dyed work embroidered for the neck as spoil?
Okay. And I have to just consult. Yeah, Dalich and the JPS soften that translation, a damsel or two, but the literal is a womb or two for every man. And that is as crude as you can get in thinking about the spoils of war, including young women. And then the other materials as spoils of war, dyed materials, embroidered, dyed work for the neck as spoil, fancy things to bring home to mom and to the wife and to everybody else. He's coming back with those, isn't he? No. Verse 31. So may all your enemies perish, O Lord, but your friends be like the sun as he rises in his might. And the land had rest for 40 years. Okay, so far? These songs in the Hebrew and in the Old Testament, the poetic tradition is amazing and rich. And you follow down the associations and the connections, and frankly, it's delightful. But we've got some time. Chapter 6, verse 1. The people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord gave them into the hand of Midian 7 years. I used to teach for 7th grade religion. There are certain ways to connect the villain and the rescuer. Midian Gideon is one of those. Midian Gideon. They rhyme. But you can remember them either through rhyming or through a certain rhythm that happens. And 7 years in the hand of Midian, and the 7 years will come back later in the story. Verse 2.
And the dominion by the power of Israel, the custom of the people of Israel, made for themselves the islands and the mountains and the caves and the strongholds.
Okay. This is worse. This is not just if you engage in trade, you have to take the back roads and the winding paths. This is, you're making a dwelling place in a cave. And this became a pattern in that part of the world. The Holy Land is littered with caves, some of them up on cliffs and in mountains and whatnot. And if you want to get a cave as a refuge, you can get a rope and come down from the top and get to the cave. You get your first person in there, then you pass the rope down and you fasten it and secure it inside the cave so that after that you can drop it down and you can have a rope ladder going up and down. You can have your whole family live in a cave because you also enlarge the cave and maybe flatten parts out and you know, maybe if the stone is soft enough, you can drive a nail in there and have a nice hanging on your wall. But that's not like living in a house. Verse 3. For whenever the Israelites planted crops, the Midianites and the Amalekites and the people of the east would come up against them. Oh, you can't even plant your crops. What are you gonna do? Verse 4.
They camped on the land and ruined the crops all the way to Gaza and did not spare a living thing for Israel, neither sheep nor cattle nor donkeys.
Okay, so the enemy is completely devouring the stuff that you have built up. And you've got nothing you can do about it. God turned you over into their hands because you were unfaithful and you worshiped other gods. Verse 5. For they would come up with their livestock and their tents. They would come like locusts in number, both they and their camels could not be counted, so that they laid waste the land as they came in. Ah. Verse 6.
And Israel was brought very low because of Midian. And the peoples of Israel cried out for help to the Lord.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now we've got the setting. When the people of Israel cried out to the Lord on account of the Midianites, verse 8,
he sent them a prophet who said, this is what the Lord, the God of Israel says. I brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery.
Wait a minute. I thought we were heading toward Gideon. Who is this? So there is first off a prophet who comes along before Gideon. And the prophet reads them the riot act and says, thus says the Lord. Now, I led you up from Egypt. Verse 9, and I delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the hand of all who oppressed you and drove them out before you and gave you their land. Verse 10.
and will say to you, I am the Lord your God, you shall not fear the gods of the Amorites, since land you fall, but not obey my voice.
Okay. So you didn't obey my voice. You didn't listen to me. I said, don't worship other gods. What'd you do? You worshiped other gods. I told you, do not fear. What'd you do? You feared. And it could go on and on and on like that. But we get to some of the interesting stuff here. Verse 11, now the angel of the Lord came and sat under the terebinth at Ophrah, which belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, while his son Gideon was beating out wheat in the wine press. Why would you beat out wheat in a wine press? Why wouldn't you grind it on a under a millstone?
Because it's out of sight.
Exactly. And you're not going to have as much in this wine press as you would if you had a millstone to do it. But maybe you don't even have the livestock to do it. Although Joash does have, he does have an ox, but you're hiding everything. Because if the Midianites find out you have food, well, then you don't have food. It's gone. In the wine press to hide it from the Midianites. Okay. So verse 12.
And the angel of the Lord appeared to him and said to him, the Lord is with you, O mighty man of valor.
Notice the with you. We've been working that theme a little bit, and we will work that theme a whole lot more through Advent, Christmas, on into Epiphany, the with you. And that is the most important thing. And then the confusing, O mighty man of valor, which Gideon does not understand what that's all about. He's going to answer back questioning, you know, how can deliverance happen with what's been going on? But that's for another week. We come to an end at this point, okay?